Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 26th day of March, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you here. We have a great panel. I'm Joe Donahue. It's nice to be back. I was off for a couple of days. I had surgery. I had kidney surgery. And it didn't go as they wanted it to go. So I'll probably have to have another one or two of these. But it was supposed to take care of everything, and it didn't because there was a lot of infection and bleeding and so forth. That's not why I'm telling you this. The reason I'm telling you this is I don't know. Do any of you know what a stent looks like?
I don't think I've ever seen one.
Now, no, I had it like maybe an inch long, sort of like a little flexi tube. It's sort of like a bungee strap. It looks like something you'd put in the back of your Dodge Ram 2400, and they just hook it on onto your kidney, and then let her go down to the bladder, and so they said, well, you may have some slight discomfort. I said, well, for how long?
And how slight.
So we're looking at a couple of weeks because they have to let the infection heal. But the great thing about it is, my God, this feels comfortable. This is great. you know, it's nothing quite like having auto parts in your abdomen. It's quite nice. I do want to thank, we got some lovely letters of people showing concern. I had a lovely letter last night I'd like to share with you. It said, Dear Joe, we've been listening to you for years and listening to the station for decades, and I was really worried. You were gone Friday. You were gone today. I'm really worried. Is everything okay? We're very much a part of the WAMC family, and I feel I feel really bad that you don't feel good, or whatever the case may be. And I wrote back and I said, well, I told the story just as I told you. I have a little, you know, a little thing going on, and we're taking care of it. And it sounds great. And I just appreciate, I said to the listener, I just appreciate, this is what the family's about, of having a wonderful family that come together, that shows concern and shows love, and sends a note and just says, is everything okay? And then they wrote me back and said, you know, Joe, you wouldn't have this problem if you weren't obese, drank diet soda, and exercised even a little bit.
Holy cow.
And I thought,
well, you can count on family.
And I said, that's what I said. Well, that is my family. All right. We got it. That's good. Thank you. I feel better.
I would say, Joe, you look like yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you can't see my kidneys.
Or are you in discomfort right now?
Yeah.
You're in pain?
Yeah. It's just that, you know, I think anyone who's had one of these things, with whether it be stones or stents or anything like that, it's that, you know, there's, it feels like there's something inside of you. And there is.
Because there is.
Yeah. Because there is. Here was my mantra. Well, I could just stay home and be miserable, or I could be here and be miserable amongst family.
We will do what we can to distract you, Joe.
Whatever Jim and March and I can do while we're here,
Thank you.
Us know if you want a
drink
of water,
yeah,
anything you need.
You know, water has its ups and downs.
Especially in kidney.
Well,
you're
supposed to drink a lot to flush, but then when you have to do it, then you have to, you know, and then that hurts, and it's a never-ending cycle. But
Stinks. I'm sorry, Joe.
That's all right. Well, it's okay. Once I lose this weight, and I start to exercise, and stop drinking what I don't know. I'll be better.
You know, it takes a lot to leave me speechless. But that response to you, and speechless doesn't work well on the radio. But that really.
I giggled. It was a laugh.
For the record, there is no diet soda on the table.
No. Only clear liquids. Let me introduce everybody to you. We'll get started, and we'll make our way through the news of the day. The Ulster County Controller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundation of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, is here. Good morning, March. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Really good to have you here. I thank you very much for taking the time out. Jim Ketterer joins us, senior fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. We were talking about that earlier, and now I made that mistake. Jim Ketterer is here. Jim, of course, is the senior fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. And Jim, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's great to be here. And I just wanted to take note of the opening music, we have John Coltrane, Giant right. Steps. So that has healing qualities. That's about some of the greatest music ever written and performed. So that's good.
Good stuff.
And I didn't have kidney surgery last week, but I was in Birmingham, Alabama, which was a lot
thing.
Better thing. No,
same
it was actually, it turned out to be a great trip. A very interesting trip, and
were you doing jazz diplomacy? Is that what you were doing?
I was speaking to the Birmingham Committee on Foreign Relations, and I also met with some students and did a talk for them. But I got a chance to explore Birmingham with some people who know it very well, and it's a fascinating place.
So that's great.
And I ate some really fantastic, not healthy, but fantastic food. So if anybody wants to write into me about my diet, it
go.
Was a
That's
lot
nice.
Of biscuits and gravy and grits, cheese grits.
We just have confession today.
Country fried. That's good.
Really good.
That's excellent. J.P. Miller joins us as well. He is the man behind the Empire Report and a dear friend. How are you, sir?
Joe, I'm good and glad to see you. You look really good, I would say.
Thank you.
Even though if you don't feel good.
No, I clean up well.
You look great.
No, I feel good. It's everything's fine. It's going to be hard not to. I think we have to start with the bridge story out of Baltimore. A cargo ship hit the Francis Scott Key Bridge, which crosses the outer Baltimore Harbor. Early this morning, the video on it is incredible. I meaning just stunning, because this big ship comes in and just strikes. I would say maybe if you're looking from left to right, a third of the way, quarter or to a third of the way in, and then the bridge just collapses, just down. And there were cars on the bridge. There were apparently people working on the bridge. Not to mention those who were in the cargo ship. So there's a lot going on right now, and the rescue effort is underway. There are reports of vehicles in the water. Two people have been rescued, and a search is underway. The number they're dealing with right now is upwards of seven people that could be missing. But obviously, that number could change. Officials are searching for road repair crews who had been working on the bridge, which is part of Interstate 695 when the cargo ship struck. After reports that the Port of Baltimore may be shut down, officials announced that traffic in and out of the port had been suspended, but said it was still processing trucks. The collapse of the bridge is likely to be a blow to the region. I think anyone who has ever been to our nation's capital or to the capital region, that capital region of Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C., knows that even on the best of days without cargo ships going into bridges, that is a horrible, horrible commute. The Beltway and getting around, it's very difficult. It's very congested and very hard. So to think that one of the main roads that is a part of that is now not available, not to mention getting over the water, is a big deal as well. So we look at this situation this morning. And just real quick before we go to the group here, I just want to say that the ship left the Port of Baltimore around 1 a.m. this morning and didn't go far. It got as far as the ship was in the port just below Baltimore City in the harbor, and then sort of went right, turned, and then went south. And then as it hit south or went south, it hit the bridge at about 1:28 a.m. So about 30 minutes after leaving is when the impact took place. And so that was the direction of the ship going eastward as opposed to westward. And the hope is that there are as few people impacted and casualties or those who are seriously injured. And then, of course, that the city can kind of get its back to some semblance of normalcy as soon as possible. Jim?
Yeah, I used to live in Maryland and have been on that bridge many, many, many times. Obviously the immediate tragedy of the people who are in peril over this is horrible. It's just horrible for any of us to think about. And you can think of any time we've ever been over a bridge and what might happen. But then the immediate follow-on effects that are going to have, you know, an impact right away. One is the traffic. I mean, the other two ways to go north-south in that part of Maryland are through tunnels. And I think a lot of the trucks are not allowed to go through those tunnels. And a lot of the goods that move around this country up and down the East Coast go by truck, and or they may arrive by ship. And the Port of Baltimore is one of the busiest ports in the country. So that's no minor thing for that port to be closed and for those roads to be closed. And obviously it's going to be a long, long time until this is pieced back together. And piecing back together also makes me think, you know, trying to understand what went wrong. JP and I were talking about it before we went on the air. When you see that video and you see how far that ship was off course, I mean, what in the world happened? It's just a monumental disaster and hard to imagine what was going on the bridge of that ship.
Absolutely, because it normally would have gone straight center and under. It didn't do that. Didn't even come close, really. And what was going on, as you say, what's going on the bridge there is going to be one of the big questions that to stand out. JP?
Yeah, it will be first of all, the loss of life and the tragedy is we kind of don't know what the volume of that is, but there will certainly be casualties coming from this. And knowing a little bit about driving boats is that boat is the heaviest boat that you can imagine in the water with all that cargo. And they're trying to get right underneath the middle of the bridge span. And once that boat is going off course, we will certainly find out what sent it off course, but why it was that far off course. Once a boat of that size has any speed and is that far off course, there's no way to stop it. You literally can't stop a ship going through the water at any kind of speed from hitting that bridge once it's that far off course. And my questions are, I don't know how many captains are in a ship like that. Is it two? Is it three? Is it one? I can't imagine it's just one. But it is something that's done tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of times with no incident, right?
And I always am cautious, March, in these situations where you don't want to speculate too much because that doesn't help anybody. But one of the questions that just naturally came to my mind is the actual structure and security of the bridge itself. Of when you have something like that, I don't know, but it would seem like it would be able to, that it's not all that out of the realm that somebody may nudge it. And this was obviously more than a nudge. But that what is the security of the bridge that would allow it just to collapse like that, as opposed to, you know, doing some severe damage in that one area?
I have a feeling we'll be planning things differently going forward because of this accident. And I also think I heard earlier that there were repair crews on the bridge, possibly at the time of the accident.
Right.
As somebody who's married to a retired iron worker, my heart goes out to those families. Like, that's already scary work. But I do think, Joe, that we're going to see changes. And I'm hoping that there is a path to speedier repair. I mean, look at the bridge collapse from the burning tanker in Pennsylvania, right? They said it was going to be months and months, and they got a temporary stand-up quickly. I think they should recruit Governor of Pennsylvania Josh Shapiro to advise on this project. It's a totally different type of infrastructure, right? It's a different kind of bridge, and there was a lot of metal on this bridge. So I don't know if they're going to be able to do something temporary that's faster here, but we're going to need it, or it's going to slow, you know, truck traffic down for the entire East Coast.
And you don't, obviously, you don't know, but you do assume that given the impact this has not only on the city of Baltimore, but that it has on our federal government with so many workers using that as a way of getting from to and from work and other systems. While D.C. has a decent metro system, I don't know that it is to the capacity that it would be able to take on such an extra load. Maybe, I don't know. I know it's had its own issues.
There's a train that runs from Baltimore to D.C., the MARC train.
That's
and,
right.
A lot of people do take that.
New Carlton Station.
Yes.
And it'll bring you right into Union Station
yeah,
in D.C.
Yeah, it does.
But whatever, you know, that comes in too, and to see where that leads us. But obviously, the immediate concern is those who are injured or are missing in the waters under the bridge, and the search goes on for that. So hopefully, we'll have some updates as time goes on. Anybody have anything else on?
Well, just that one survivor was pulled from the water, which is 48 degrees, and that's pretty amazing. So hopefully they'll.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
And I saw in the press conference that I saw this morning at around 7:15 that the FBI has ruled out terrorism, and they wouldn't. From what I saw in the press conference, it seems like they wouldn't come out as strong saying that they were ruling out terrorism if there was any question of that.
And who knows, but boy, it sure didn't look like, I mean, it just looked like it made a wrong turn and went right into the bridge. But who knows? More to come on that. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll check in on new topics with our terrific group, and we'll be back after this message and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back. A couple letters regarding the bridge in Baltimore, the Francis Scott Key Bridge, and people are chiming in. Mark says the location of the Key Bridge marks the place where Francis Scott Key watched the bombardment of Baltimore in September 1814, so it is not just an important piece of infrastructure, but a kind of touchstone to the great moment of local history. It will ache tremendously to drive on the east side of Baltimore and think of the human tragedy and the loss of a significant memorial. That from Mark. We then go to Thomas, ship's captains never take their ships in and out of ports. Pilots who work only in the port bring them in and out. So that is from Thomas. I know that is a case often. I don't know if that was the case here, but I do. That certainly sounds possible.
But that makes it even more puzzling.
Shocking,
if
yeah.
It's pilots who really understand.
That's their job. They do it every day, right?
That, you know, all the, you know, intricacies of getting in and out of that harbor.
We're getting chastised for calling it a boat. Did we call it a boat? I think it's a ship.
I think it's a ship.
It's a cargo ship. Yeah. Dear panel, Francis Scott Key Bridge was built in 1977. Since then, the size and capacity of cargo ships has metastasized. From pre-accident photos of the bridge, it certainly appears the piers supporting the main span were designed for aesthetics and economy and were not armored, as one sees with designs of 19th century masonry piers. Against collision with a ship, the size of which could have never been imagined at the time. That's sort of what I was alluding to earlier. It has been reported, writes Brett, that the ship lost propulsion at least once before the bridge collision. If you watch the video, you can see all of the ship's lights go out on several times before impact. Full power loss, a very unfortunate incident. And again, I know we'll be hearing a lot more.
National Transportation Safety Board just announced on Twitter they're launching a go team to investigate, and they will be holding a press conference later today. I was wondering, like, who actually investigates? Is it NTSB? But it is. I wondered, like, does it differ on these water accidents? But no, it's them.
Jennifer writes, both BBC and the New York Times say the reason for the collision is that the ship lost power. I think even in the video shown in the New York Times, you can see the lights going on and off, as brought up by another listener. So we'll obviously be watching this story and be covering on it throughout our news magazines throughout the day, as well as NPR coverage throughout the day as well. Let us move on to other subjects and talk about other things that are, well, they're not as tragic, and yet I guess they are. Anyway, Donald Trump has a trial date. He can actually circle the calendar. Tax day is his day. April 15th has been set as the date for a trial. He is poised to become the first ex-president to go on trial on criminal charges in a case related to hush money paid to a porn star. Trump is all but certain to become the first former American president to stand trial. On Monday, he denied his effort to delay the proceeding and confirmed it will begin next month. The judge did that, denied the effort yesterday. The trial in which Mr. Trump will be accused of orchestrating the cover-up and a simmering sex scandal surrounding the 2016 presidential campaign had originally been scheduled to start this week, but the judge had pushed the start date to April 15th to allow Mr. Trump's lawyers to review newly disclosed documents from a related federal investigation. Mr. Trump's lawyers had pushed for an even longer delay of 90 days and sought to have the case thrown out altogether. But in an hour-long hearing Monday, the Justice Merchan slammed their arguments, rejecting them all. In a particularly low moment for the defense team, the judge questioned the claims and eventually the resume of one of Mr. Trump's lawyers as the former president looked on.
Well, I guess we're going to get our trial, at least one of these trials, kicked off. You know, there's four separate criminal cases right now. They're active, and it's confusing to the reader and the listener to figure out exactly what trial is what. But this one that's going to have its trial start date is for falsifying business records in the hush money case. I'm kind of looking forward to hearing Michael Cohen, who I hear is going to be the star witness of that trial. I'd like to hear what his former lawyer has to say. But I want to note caution, because I feel that I've been hearing, particularly from my more conservative or Republican friends, that they feel that there is just a Trump witch hunt. The excessive damages on the other case, on the civil case in New York, really, I think, gave rise to that, right? Most of us have heard about the $10 million McDonald's hot coffee litigation, and we don't, as citizens, trust these ginormous damages. Even if the punitive damages there could be justified, I think it undermines confidence in the system. Folks that I'm talking about also feel that way about these trials, that these trials are just set up to make the president look bad. And it's unfortunate that we couldn't get these trials happening sooner. I think there's a lot of regret on the part of Department of Justice for not moving these things quicker, because now it is bumping into the election cycle. So I want to hear what Michael Cohen has to say. I hope that it doesn't undermine confidence in the legal system.
Jim?
Yeah, just to follow on that about how this is being spun politically, you know, I think that for people who think that the problem of Donald Trump is going to be solved in the courtroom, they're just dreaming. That's not going to be the solution to this particular issue, because the issue is a political issue, and it's got to be solved politically. It's going to have to be solved at the polls in November, and whatever happens after November, which will probably be dramatic in one way or another. And so, you know, before anybody decides to write in and say that I'm dismissing the importance of these cases, I'm not. But it's still, no matter what happens with them over the next few months, it is not going to solve the political problem, for exactly the reasons that March was saying, that in each of these cases, you can see that it has been, and there's particular different kinds of spin for each one, but they've been spun in a way that allow Donald Trump to get a lot more publicity, to have it be a witch hunt, to that he's the victim, and, you know, and for him to employ all the tactics that he learned so well from Roy Cohn. And so I think that, you know, this will go on in April, this next case, and the other cases will drag on. But this is not the answer to that people are looking for.
I agree with March and Jim. So March, April 15th, they announced that, and I thought, oh, well, that's a while away. And then you look at the calendar, and that's just 3 weeks from today. So 3 weeks from today is going to be a significantly historic event in the history of the United States, which is a former president is going to be put on criminal trial. anybody that's read Michael Cohen's book, which I have, it's an excellent book, kind of knows the facts of this case and what the president did. I would say that it's certain to most people on both sides that the president definitely did this. But I agree with you that of the four criminal cases, this, I would say the strongest, if I was President Biden and I wanted one to happen, I would want the January 6th case to go forward. That's something that as voters are reminded of what happens on January 6th and as voters are reminded of the former president's role in orchestrating January 6th and not calling the police when it was happening on January 6th, that's one that I could see as being an advantage to President Biden and a disadvantage to President Trump. Out of those four cases, I would also say, though, that this case being brought by Alvin Bragg is the least politically advantageous to President Biden and potentially beneficial to Trump. As you said, I think he's going to use this to call himself a martyr. He's the victim. And it's hard to look at the justice system through a political lens, but that's really, at the end, I think, what matters. And I agree with you both that I think this is potentially something that could prove the political benefit of President Trump.
And you can also see that he's trying to insulate himself from the blowback on January 6th, and I think he's doing it pretty successfully. When he starts a rally, he has the national anthem. It's a recording of some of the people who have been, I think, convicted of January 6th crimes singing the national anthem, and he refers to them as hostages, as political prisoners, as patriots, and this is playing very well with his base, and kind of solidifying and mobilizing that base has always been the strength of his political movement. I think. I don't know what the two of you think about that.
I agree. It helps him with his base, but that's one where my belief is, I could be wrong about this, is that moderates, the people in the middle that are going to decide this next election, when my belief is when they're reminded of January 6th, it makes them less likely to vote for Trump. And I think that that is... If that, you know, you can't decide what criminal cases are coming up at what times, but I would say that's the strongest and most politically damaging, and with moderates, those that are going to decide the election. And I think that this Alvin Bragg case, as we've seen, you know, we've seen Trump's poll numbers go up since he's started to get indicted. These 92 indictments have put his poll numbers up, and this trial has the potential to, I think, help him with moderates rather than hurt him with moderates.
The elected prosecutors, I think, can be seen in that political framework, and that stands for both, you know, Tish James and Alvin Bragg. So both those cases, I think, are seen through that lens, and probably Fannie Willis as well. It's very hard to separate, whereas Jack Smith was really an appointee. So it's a slightly different lens. I think it's funny that the trial is going to start on tax day. I think that's incredibly ironic and appropriate. But I also just want to note, this is a white-collar case, right? The crime in the case that we're talking about is falsifying business records. Unfortunately, white-collar does not motivate people. It's not seen in the same way. You know, we kind of live in a country in a time where people who scam are awarded with reverence and not disdain like they should be. And white collar falls right into that. And I agree with JP. I think the criminal case that was really about January 6th would be much, much, much more compelling. People are talking about how this is really a fundraising exercise for him. All of these cases, he's not getting to do campaign rallies the way he did. His last rally was March 16th, I think. But it's important to note the campaign numbers, the fundraising numbers. In February, Trump raised $33.5 million. Biden raised $77 million. So it's not helping his fundraising. I think regular people who might have supported Trump don't want their fundraising dollars going to pay for legal bills. They want to see support for candidates on the ground. And that's not what the Republican National Committee is about right now.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. March Gallagher, Jim Ketterer, and J.P. Miller with us this morning as we talk about a wide range of issues. We are currently on the trial date of April 15th being set for the Donald Trump hush money case and trying to prognosticate a little bit as to what will happen there. We have a lot of letters. Let me get to those. Frank says, you keep talking about it motivating his base, which is shrinking. Polling hasn't been right for years. Saying that the trail is going to make moderates vote for Trump, excuse me, is the silliest thing I've heard so far this week. Did we say that?
I don't think we said that, but I'm always open to the charge of being silly, but I'm not sure I was silly in that way.
Okay. Leslie writes, it has been my understanding from listening to legal scholars that the documents case, the one that the Supreme Court decided to hear with regard to presidential immunity, is actually the strongest case and should have been a slam dunk had the Supreme Court not intervened. Then we go to this. Richard, let's assume that every, shouty caps, every so-called conservative is engaged in cognitive dissonance that allows them to see the former president as an unjustly persecuted great patriot. Where does that leave the various public servants whose sworn duty it is to hold up the law without fear or favor? Should they just ignore the criminality? Every one of these prosecutors and some of the judges have been subjected to a barrage of harassment. Some have received death threats. If we can't support these public servants and allow them to do their jobs, we don't deserve to have them.
Who's not supporting them? I mean, us or?
I think they're talking about so-called conservatives.
Oh, the conservatives not supporting. Yeah, I understand that.
I think it was interesting. Liz Cheney, this is in response to speaking about McDaniel, Rona McDaniel getting a position a position at NBC, but she was saying that McDaniel.
I really want to talk about that today.
That she facilitated Trump's corrupt fake election plot and was enabling criminality and depravity. So I do think there are conservatives. Nobody can say Liz Cheney is not a conservative, and I do not think that she supports Trump. There are a lot of conservatives who don't support Trump. It's hard to be vocal, I think, for those folks, but they're trying and they have some leaders leading the way. The documents case that you were just mentioning, Joe, was set for trial April 24th in Fort Pierce, Florida, but it's widely accepted and expected that it's going to be postponed. So, you know, we're going to see some activity, some courtroom activity on that case as well.
I would just say on that case, though, it does appear to be a very strong case against him in terms of the politics. They've been able to insulate themselves pretty well by saying Joe Biden did the same thing. Joe Biden had classified documents, shared those classified documents who did not have clearances, and therefore, you know, what about that? What about Joe? And that whataboutism has been very, very powerful, I think, in insulating them on the political impact of this case.
I mean, the pictures of the documents in the bathroom, how was that just not the end of the conversation? I just, you know, we've taken on a farcical sort of approach to these things.
There's a lot of farce. JP?
Yeah, I don't follow the legal proceedings as much as I should on the documents, but I do think that the fact pattern of Biden having been caught with classified documents as well is an excellent political tool for the Republicans to use to say Biden did the same thing, even if it wasn't exactly the same thing.
When you think about the overall, well, let me get to another part of this, which is we've just got about 6 or 7 minutes before the top of the hour break. So we're talking about but one of those, in this case, the trial date. As far as the fraud judgment that was $500 million, just under $500 million, and it was seen that would be difficult for a lot of people, even extremely wealthy people, to come up with that amount of money. So in the appeals, now, as of yesterday, the judge said there will be a partial stay of the fraud judgment, and he's now allowed to post $175 million, which, as of last night, I believe he was still balking at, right? So whether that even will be paid is another question. But I think for some of us, myself included, felt that $500,000 or $500 million seemed like a lot of money and a very difficult thing to for it to stick.
Well, as we were saying on the break, it's the bond, right? It was a $450 million bond. But I agree, and I think it undermines the legitimacy of the case because it sounds so large. It doesn't matter to me if it's fully justified on the law and the facts, which it probably is, because the public hears that number and they just think it's ridiculous. I had a friend on Facebook post yesterday, quote, that he's checking in safe from having Tish James seize his assets. So there is a whole narrative about how unfair this is to Donald Trump. I did see that he said that he would be, quote, honored to post the bond at this level. So I think he will, or he's saying that he will comply. Whether he actually does or not, we'll see. But he's starting to say that he will comply, that it's more reasonable. He was sort of complimenting, you know, the appeals court that set this number. And I'm hoping that it'll legitimize the case in a way that the $450 million number doesn't.
Amidst all this, Donald Trump was also putting out information saying that he has won the golf championship at his country club. And so
he looks so proud with that plaque.
Both the club championship and the senior club championship.
Yeah, and I saw that President Biden or President Biden's account responded and said, "Congratulations, Donald. That sounds like quite an accomplishment."
I love the trolling.
Yes.
The trolling.
All right.
This is the level of our political dialogue these days.
That's great, isn't it? Excellent. Let's go to some letters. The cases in New York and Georgia are crucial to our democracy in the future because Donald Trump cannot shut them down. So we will see about that on with a subject line of Alvin Bragg. Jeff writes, the challenge for Bragg is change the moniker of this case from hush money to voter deception, which is exactly what it is. This case is about election interference. Constant through thread with Donald Trump. Anybody want to comment on that? Hearing no one, I will move on.
No, it's the most important case. I mean, I think we all agree with that. It's primary.
With the hush money case.
No, the election interference. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. But well,
I think they're saying hush money case
is election interference.
That's my take on it,
at
least in the letter. Brad says, I think that the trial begins on April 15th actually has the potential to significantly harm the former president. I believe there is more of an upside for Biden. If there is a conviction in particular, many Republicans have registered this inclination in voting and supporting the former president if he is convicted. That is a big if at this point, but there's almost 7 months between the start of this trial, which should last maybe 6 weeks. And the general election. That from Brad.
But I would just say again that, you know, Democrats cannot rely on Donald Trump self-immolating or Joe Biden being able to say, well, look, I'm not Donald Trump. Joe Biden needs to be able to run strongly on his accomplishments. He needs to be able to articulate them. He needs to be able to finally convince Americans that the economy is doing as well as he says it is doing, and have them really feel it. And in the absence of that, it really is a very weak fallback position to hope that these cases are going to win the election in November.
Agreed. You cannot overcome fascism with logic. And I think that's been the playbook right now. And we need to get away from that and speak to emotion, which is what's driving most voters.
Maureen says, well, March, thank you for being the megaphone for, quote, your Republican friends. Did you really want to demean the woman who is in the center of the scandal?
What woman is that? Is that Stormy Daniels? No, I'm not trying to demean Stormy Daniels. I think it's interesting that Stormy Daniels is now speaking more openly about how terrified she was, and we're sort of seeing her relationship with Trump and the activities that happened in a different light, that she really was abused and that she was in a very jeopardized position. And I'm glad that she's able to speak about it now in a different way. And I do think it's important, if we're going to meet in the middle on things, to listen to and acknowledge people who may have views that disagree with us. So that's why I am being the megaphone for my Republican friends. I am a Democrat. I'm a registered Democrat and elected official. But I like to hear all sides, and I like to try to understand where people are coming from on all sides.
Jeremy writes, Trump has never been held accountable for anything in his life. The trials are a way to do that. With that, we'll take a break, and we'll come back in just a moment. We'll have news with the Ray Graff, and then we'll return and move on to other topics with our terrific group, Marsh Gallagher, Jim Ketterer, and J.P. Miller. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 26th of March. Very nice to have you with us. Marsh Gallagher, J.P. Miller, and Jim Ketterer make up the group. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Just a couple quick letters and then we'll move on to other things. Olaf says, conservatives feel that the justice system is being unfairly applied to Trump. Are you kidding me? Yes, the justice system is skewed, but it's skewed in favor of Trump. If anything has been proven in this whole sordid affair, it's that there are two justice systems in this country, one for the rich and the powerful and one for anybody else. And what does it say of America that is adjudicated, that adjudicated rapist and known corrupt liar and thief and criminal huckster is the leading contender for president of the United States? Then we go to this letter from Charlie. It's doing a disservice to refer to the amount as a penalty or fine. We need to remind people that this is a disgorgement. It is the amount the court has determined to be ill-gotten gains, not an arbitrary amount set at the court's whims.
True.
What is a disgorgement?
Removing the profits, how much he profited and benefited from the exercise of inflating the values.
So how do you take it then legally from the total that it was to the total it is now?
I think legal scholars would say there's not really a good way to do that. And that
did he sell the properties for a profit?
Well, he benefited by getting lower interest rates. I mean, they went through a series of calculations to come up with the 450. I didn't mean to imply that there's no basis. I'm saying there is a basis, but it still seems unreasonable to regular people on the ground.
Because I would say that letter that the listener very smartly wrote is the first time that I had heard that. And
see?
I don't read these stories, you know,
right,
all the time, but that's news to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the actual written judgment, the judge lays out basically the math on how they came to that figure. And Marsh, do I have this right that it's the amount of the bond that was reduced, but not the final judgment? The final amount that he actually owes eventually is still that larger number.
It is still the larger number, and this is how much he would have had to post during
right.
the appeal.
Right.
And that's why I think the appeals court was able to modify it, saying he doesn't have to do that to file his appeal. But this goes back to what the reader said. That feels like something that a wealthy individual is getting, somebody who the legal system is working for. It does feel like there's two systems of judgment of justice. And if you were of lesser means with fewer attorneys and less press and all this, you would never get that modification to the bond value.
But if he doesn't win the appeal, he still will owe that larger amount.
Correct.
Because I think that's not been clear in some of the reporting that I've been seeing.
And posting the bond for the $172 million, does that mean that he has to get $172 million of cash out of his account and give it to the government, or he has to get like 10% of the $172 million?
I think
million?
He has to get the $175 million, but what I thought was so interesting is that I would have expected that he could post real estate itself for the value, and he can't. it actually has to be like real money. It
has to be cash.
It cannot be an asset. Yeah.
And do you think that that cash can generate interest while it's sitting in wherever it sits?
Ooh, great question. I don't have the answer to
that. Because in the days of zero interest rates, you would say, all right, there's no opportunity cost.
Now there's a huge cost.
Yeah.
We could have invested that $175 million in Truth Social.
There is that. All right, let's move on to other topics and find out what else is going on in this world of ours. I'd like to talk a little bit about the UN and the Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza as the United States abstains on this. The United Nations Security Council on Monday passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip during the remaining weeks of Ramadan, breaking a five-month impasse during which the U.S. vetoed three calls for a halt to the fighting. The resolution passed with 14 votes in favor and the U.S. abstaining, which U.S. officials said they did in part because the resolution did not condemn Hamas. In addition to a ceasefire, the resolution also called for the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages and the lifting of all barriers to the provision of humanitarian assistance. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel immediately criticized the U.S. for allowing the resolution to pass and ordered a delegation scheduled to go to Washington to hold high-level talks with the U.S. officials to remain in Israel instead. A lot going on. What do we make of it, Jim Hemler? No, Jim Ketterer. Damn it.
Well, Jim Hemler can write in too. I'm sure he has a.
I'm sure he has an answer, but yeah. I'm asking Jim Ketterer.
So this resolution, you know, I think partially has to be seen in terms of the U.S. abstention, in terms of domestic politics. And so the Biden administration is trying to thread a very difficult needle on being supportive of Israel and being consistent in that support, as Biden has been since October 7th, and at the same time somehow finding a way to address the really major concerns of certain aspects, certain components of the Democratic Party. And this, you know, drumbeat for a ceasefire has gotten louder and louder and louder. So I think the abstention is the latest administration effort to try to thread that needle. In terms of the resolution itself, I mean, it has no binding power, and the Netanyahu government has said they're not going to adhere to it, that they will proceed with their plans, and particularly proceed with their plans for some sort of military operation in the southern part of Gaza in Rafah, which is right on the Egyptian border. And so, you know, it lays down a marker in one way. But on the other hand, you know, I think it will just raise expectations that are not necessarily going to be met. The real action is in the direct negotiations that are not part of the UN that are going on that have to include Hamas and have to include the Israelis, have to include the combatants, and not only address the ceasefire issue. And, you know, Ramadan will be ending relatively soon, so it's not just for doing it for the sake of Ramadan, but also getting at the issue that has not been really addressed seriously by the Israeli government, which is what are the actual broader aims of this conflict? I mean, to say seeking the absolute destruction and elimination of Hamas is, number one, it just can't be the entire set of war aims, and secondly, does not appear to be actually doable. So in absence of anything else, what is going on? And I'm hopeful that the conversations that are happening, back-channel conversations that are happening with the Israelis, that there's some clarity on this, because there's certainly none publicly.
So yesterday there was, you know, a press conference with Jean-Pierre and also John Kirby, who is the national security communications advisor and I think a former admiral, and he said we still have Israel's back and that the decision was not based on domestic politics but national security, which is the statement they're making. It doesn't feel totally true because of the reasons that you were just mentioning, Jim. You know, and he also said, you know, that Israel needs to be able to defend itself. Civilian casualties must come down and humanitarian aid must get in. Those things don't feel like they're happening. And particularly with respect to what is the plan later, right? Like, what is the ultimate plan here? What is the goal? Where are we trying to get to? That feels really unclear at this point. And I don't feel like they've made big efforts to state that. And I said this the last time I was on the air. I don't feel like the Netanyahu government cares one bit about what's happening in the United States, which I think is a mistake politically, because what happens here is going to dictate how supportive the United States is of Israel going forward. And I also see there's some like dissension among maybe the Israeli war cabinet, with Benny Gantz criticizing Netanyahu and saying Netanyahu himself should come for a visit and talk to Biden. So I, you know, this is an area where somebody just at a low level of government in the United States trying to follow the national news really has a hard time keeping track of what's going on. I said this to Jim on the break. I didn't understand what it meant by non-binding, you know, and then I was looking at other resolutions, like there was a resolution opposing Israel's a UN resolution against Israel building more settlements in 2016. That's been completely overridden and violated. You know, no one's paid any attention to that. So
yeah,
it feels very fruitless.
Well, I mean, part of it is just the nature of the UN. The UN is a product of nation states that have created it and run it. And it is not the global COP. It has no enforcement policy. It has no power without the major permanent members of the UN Security Council agreeing to it and putting up the resources behind any particular resolution. So that's one thing. And, you know, I just have to say I'm not sure it's the case that Netanyahu doesn't care at all about what's going on in domestic American politics. I think he's playing domestic American politics. I think he's perfectly happy to paint Joe Biden into a corner. And tacitly, I think he is very supportive of the candidacy of Donald Trump.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I think that I agree, Jim, that that really the decider, other than the Israeli government, of what's happening right now in the Middle East is the United States. And without Biden's tacit support, Netanyahu would not be able to be executing what he is executing right now in Israel and with the war. And you know, the UN is not obviously relevant here. So I'm amazed that they would even put out this resolution. They are themselves showing that they're irrelevant.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, I would say across the Middle East and North Africa, my experience has been that the UN is not seen as relevant, and that there's general hostility toward the UN, not just from the Israeli government, but not just from governments, but from people across the region who have seen it deliver one empty promise after another. Now, this is not to say that the UN doesn't have real value and real promise, but in these kinds of conflicts, again, it's the question is, how is it created? It's created by other countries, and how is it run? And so it can't do things on its own. There is no such thing. It just doesn't exist. So, you know, that I think is the reality on the ground.
You know, the United States is really struggling to define and explain why they didn't veto this resolution, right? And I was looking at comments where Kirby, Admiral Kirby, was saying the ones we did veto didn't condemn Hamas. This one didn't condemn Hamas, which is why we couldn't support it, but we didn't veto it because, in general, unlike previous resolutions, this one did fairly capture what has been our consistent policy, which is linking the hostage deal and the release of those men and women with a temporary ceasefire.
And I think Kirby went on to say, and we assumed that this was also the Israeli position, and now they're saying it's not.
Right.
There's another thing, too, just going back to something that JP said about Israel wouldn't be able to be conducting the conflict in the way that it is without the support of the United States, that the U.S. obviously has a central role in this. This is exactly the point being made by many people who are calling for a ceasefire and many people who are saying that the United States should have more conditionality with regard to the weaponry that we're giving to the Israelis. And I think it was just yesterday also that the National Security Council released a statement that said that they had found that the Israelis are not violating international standards and American law and the use of that weaponry. So the same day that this is going on in the UN, the U.S. is also saying that the relationship that we have with regard to military assistance will continue.
I wonder if that will be the case if, you know, there are operations in Rafah, because that seems like it's crossing a line. And, you know, it looks like it's going to be very hard to come back from that. You know, there's millions of people there. There's starvation happening. And Israel is still saying we're going to root out Hamas there.
Yeah, and all of what's going on in Rafah also raises the broader question in the absence of any kind of clear war plans and endgame here, that that you have members of the cabinet, the Israeli cabinet, who are saying, well, what their endgame is to displace huge numbers of Palestinians from Gaza, send them into Sinai, let the Egyptians deal with them, and that the Egyptians have been paid handsomely through many different ways to do this, and that's the end game. Now, that would really be a completely other order of magnitude of this conflict, and that would be not just tantamount to, but that would be the definition of ethnic cleansing. But there are cabinet members who are saying that out loud.
It's horrible what's happening, and I just want to note that yesterday in Kingston, actually, there was a banner hung on one of our temples that said, and I'm not going to say the word because we're on radio, F Israel. It was very large, and there's a huge amount of anti-Semitism taking root globally and in the United States and right here in New York. And as a Jew, I just have to say it absolutely terrifies me. It absolutely terrifies me, and it makes it hard for me to even really use my regular analytical tools to judge what's happening, you know, internationally, because I just shut down. I freeze. I go into freeze mode when I'm trying to read and evaluate the news. And, you know, what's happening overseas is driving sentiment here in the United States in a very ugly way.
Yeah, and people who are engaged in that kind of ugly criminal behavior seem to be unable to or unwilling to understand that one can criticize the Israeli government and specific policies without calling for the end of the existence of the state of Israel.
Right.
Jim, do you think Hamas wants to end the conflict or no?
I think that Hamas is benefiting in some ways from this conflict and the way that it has played out. I think that in several ways Israel has done exactly what Hamas wanted them to do. And we can see that their support, which was low before October 7th, has gone up quite a bit in Gaza and in the West Bank. And the West Bank is really on the boil, too, and it's not getting the attention that I think it really deserves, that there's likely to be, you know, massive explosion coming from the West Bank as well. So I think that Hamas will try to negotiate something that will keep them in existence and will be to their advantage in a tactical way. And strategically, I think that they seek to continue a conflict on some level going forward. Whether it's an immediate end to the military conflict, that wouldn't be the end to what they perceive as their existential conflict.
Do you see any scenario under which the hostages are returned to their families?
I think so. I think that Hamas is still ready to deal with whatever hostages are still alive. Sadly, I don't think there's a good reckoning of how many are alive and how many aren't. But Hamas has benefited from the release of political prisoners and prisoners in general, prisoners however defined. And, you know, the Israelis have released many more of those prisoners than there have been hostages released. So I think Hamas has seen this as a victory.
When let me just get to a couple of the letters here before we go to a bottom of the hour break. John says a couple of thoughts about Israel and Gaza. How is it that Israel doesn't have enough weaponry stockpiled to fight a ragtag force like Hamas? What would happen if they had to fight a real war with Syria or Iran? I was a lifelong Republican until the Tea Party and MAGA crowd showed up, but still consider myself conservative. The government of Israel has lost my support. If they are losing people like me, they are in big trouble in the future. Israel must allow more aid to the Palestinians in Gaza. And that is from John.
I just want to say one thing about that, Joe. So we have seen since October 7th that Israel's international standing has taken an enormous hit. And as I said, at least in the West Bank and in Gaza, Hamas, which had had a very low standing among its own people, has gone up.
Here's a letter for us, although I think it was like catered for Jim. Like, I think this could have been, we could have put this out and had the special ordered for Jim. This is from Frederica. I do not understand the role of Egypt. Why is there no or very limited aid held at the Egyptian border? All the news focuses on the starving Palestinians, the U.S. and Israel. It seems that Egypt could act on creating a passage for the aid.
Yeah, I mean, the Egyptian role is really one. It's a long and tangled story. Just so we're clear, Egypt has a small part of the border with Gaza. The current Egyptian government has worked hand in glove with the Israeli government over the last many years on the quote-unquote management of Gaza. The Egyptian government is no fan at all of Hamas. Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood. The current government in Egypt came to power by carrying out a coup d'etat against a Muslim Brotherhood president in Egypt and has since imprisoned or otherwise removed all Muslim Brotherhoods from the political spectrum in Egypt. So there's no real sense of brotherhood, to put it mildly, between the Egyptian government and Hamas. That having been said, you know, Egypt and many other governments are reluctant to just say, well, we're going to open the doors and bring in Palestinians into our territory, because we've seen that happen before and the Palestinians are never allowed to return. And you have multiple generations of Palestinians living after having been displaced. And so the Egyptian government, for all of its other many problems, would not want to run afoul of its own population's great support for the Palestinian people by being seen as being complicit in ethnic cleansing.
We'll pause there and take a break. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll have time for another topic or two upon our return and our last break with our panel. March Gallagher, Jim Ketterer, and J.P. Miller make up the group. And again, we welcome you. We'll return after this break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us in our last break here with our group. March Gallagher, J.P. Miller, and Jim Ketterer. And as always, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. As we speak, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments on abortion pill access. A decision by the justices could cut off prescriptions by telemedicine and pills sent by mail and also have implications for the regulatory authority of the FDA. Arguments are underway, and the case means that abortion is once again before the court, less than 2 years after a conservative majority eliminated the constitutional right to abortion and said it would cede the question of access to the people and their elected representatives. So what should we be listening for during these oral arguments?
I'm worried about the FDA's ability to regulate. I mean, it's not just abortion access to Mifepristone. I'm not saying it correctly. But, you know, whether or not the FDA has the authority to regulate drugs in a certain way. And what it is they lifted some of the regulations over this drug during the course of the pandemic. You originally had to take the drug or get access to the drug within 7 weeks of the pregnancy, of the beginning of the pregnancy. You had to have an in-person doctor's visit. Those requirements were changed, extending it to 10 weeks and dropping the in-person consultation. I'll tell you, when I realized that this was before the court, I immediately went online and I was like, how do I get access to this drug? How do I stockpile this for myself and my kids? but it's not just access to this drug right now. It's questioning and throwing into a gray area what the FDA is going to be able to do and all federal agencies going forward on regulatory actions.
Jim?
Well, on the politics of this, you know, this issue in general really plays well for the Democrats and plays hard against the Republicans. And I think there's a lot of Republican politicians who realize that. You know, we saw with the Alabama IVF decision that even from Donald Trump and others, there was a lot of very fast backpedaling on the issue. And so, you know, it's just a great motivator for the Democratic base to get out and to vote to demonstrate that, you know, elections matter. And if you don't elect the right people, you're going to get people on courts that are going to make these sorts of decisions. And even, you know, not just on this specific decision, but on the whole range of them on the state level and on the federal level. So I think that, you know, it's really frightening in terms of people's actual lives. But in terms of the politics leading up to November, I think in a way this is really highly politically beneficial for the Democrats.
JP?
I agree. And it's while it's a relatively small percentage of people that say that this is the issue that they're going to vote on, if that percentage holds, it can easily sway the election. If there are 5 or 7% of the electorate for whom this is their top issue, and this is an issue that over the before the Dobbs decision, this was not a top issue on which people actually voted for. People certainly had strong opinions, but it was not one that people actually voted for. But you've seen in the last two national elections that people have voted on this issue in large in larger numbers, and it is certainly one that can sway the election. I saw Governor Hochul earlier today was on Morning Joe saying that New York has stockpiled 150,000 of these pills, and she is closely watching the proceedings today and going to, tailor legislation going forward based on what happens today.
The case is being argued by Josh Hawley's wife, Erin Hawley. I mean, what's with these power couples trying to control everything that we do? It harkened back to the music Tipper Gore days to me when I heard that. But she's really representing a very small group of doctors that came forward after the Dobbs decision. And there's, you know, basically every medical organization and all, you know, drug manufacturers on the other side saying, you know, we need to preserve not only this medication, but the FDA's abilities here.
All right, let's go to, we have about a little less than 10 minutes. I want to talk about Ronna McDaniel and the, I must say I love media stories, but I love this story, right?
Yes.
It's pretty good. It's a pretty good story.
I love it.
I mean, we don't love what's happening. I want to make that clear. I just want the story itself is just so goofy that, all right. So there's not a lot of value for journalists in interviewing an echo instead of standing inside a canyon trying to ask follow-up questions of the words bouncing off the walls around you. Better to just go to the source. Ronna McDaniel's tenure as chair of the RNC unfolded in the Trump era of American politics. She assumed the position a day before Trump was inaugurated and remained there until he decided it was time for her to go. As the head of a party actually led by the former president, McDaniel's role was largely centered on having the party do the things it normally does and then appearing at news conferences to nod along with the things that Trump was saying. He'd shout, she'd echo, but last week NBC News decided it was worth paying her money, real money, for what she had to say. Now, McDaniel debuted her role as a commentator, although the network says that she was already a scheduled guest and was not a commentator, even though she was on an NBC program and commenting. And then she tried to explain to the host, Kristen Welker, that she did not have a point of view that did extend, that she did have a point of view that did extend beyond serving as Trump's hype man. When you're the RNC chair, you kind of take one for the whole team, right? She said, now I get to be a little bit more myself, right? She said. Well, that made the one person in politics that you don't want to make mad, Chuck Todd. Don't tick off Chuck Todd. So he is mad at the network for hiring her in the first place. And as she was distancing herself from the rhetoric celebrating those arrested for the riot of Capitol on the Capitol on January 6th, celebrations to which she said she objected. But when Welker later pointed to McDaniel's new claim that President Biden had been elected fair and square to ask why viewers should trust her, the former party chair insisted she was being consistent. How can you not love this? JP.
My view is that NBC News is in a little bit of a tough position. One is, do you need paid commentators on both sides? That's a question that I don't know the answer to. But let's assume that you want a paid Republican commentator to help you cover the presidential election here in 2024. It's a small pool to choose from, of which there are Trump supporters that somehow aren't inconsistent on stuff like January 6th and whether the election was stolen and whether Trump has committed crimes. It's I think it's a tough position. So you can either hire a Republican who is anti-Trump, which is basically for all intents and purposes for this election a Democrat, or you can hire someone like Ronna McDaniel, who is a Trump apologist and has been a spokesperson for Trump, and you're going to get in trouble with you know, your own journalists, your viewership, your credibility, and all that. But if you want to somehow try to understand the electorate and understand the other side, my problem is I can't think of someone else other than Ronna McDaniel who might be a better candidate who is a Trump apologist.
No. I mean, anyone in the orbit, I guess, but not to have that kind of well, he's burned a lot of bridges. So even in this case, you wonder what's going to go on. I'll just say that for even on this show, when we have someone with a conservative view on, people just lose their lunch. I mean, they're batty over it. And I understand it. I get it. But you say, well, just what you articulated. We want to have this side represented. We want to have this as a point of conversation, and we would like to know who, what is thought of in this realm, so we can talk about how we move forward. And you often get this, which I think is the case in Ron McDaniel too, of okay, well, we don't mind a conservative, but we need another kind of conservative. We need somebody who's not an apologist, or we need somebody who's not this or not that or this or not that. And it worries me that. I mean, look, NPR gets this, we get this, NBC gets it of being a liberally biased news organization. And anything that you do like this is going to only inflame that. And I guess I just come down on the words are being said by a lot of people, and I think people need to hear them in different settings and different places, and have other experts go after them and have a conversation. That seems to be healthy in a democracy, but I which is a long way of saying that I hope NBC doesn't fire her.
Interesting. I wonder if the 24/7 news cycle hasn't driven down our standards. I don't agree that you can't find anybody else who could do this. I think there are retired governors. I don't have a list, but I'm going to come back to you with one in email, JV, of people that would be better.
But for all of us, I think, right. I think if you were doing a job search, maybe, but you also want somebody who is in the news. You want somebody who is a name, and you want somebody who's going to bring in the numbers. I mean, it's a business, right?
Right. Right. And so, if NBC didn't hire her, who would? You know, I was looking at her history. I mean, she was head of the RNC for 7 years. That's a long tenure. That's a big part of your career. You know, but she is somebody who, you know, actively participated in threatening democracy, in my opinion. So to me, I have some lines that in the sand, and I feel like she crossed them. So that's where I stand on it.
But if you were to get somebody who, you know, meets the kind of conditions that you were talking about, Joe, that people say, well, we need another kind of conservative. If it was a Never Trumper or somebody from the Lincoln Project or something, they would be immediately dismissed, and they also wouldn't have they just wouldn't be able to represent the perspective that somebody like Ronna McDaniel could. I'm not saying they should keep her or not keep her, but it is a very small group of people, as you said, JP, who would be in that pool of candidates.
But is it really a straw horse? Because real conservatives and Trump supporters are not watching NBC or MSNBC, and they're not going to necessarily even see her comments.
Well, this is a business, right? I think this is a business decision on their part, and not a maybe not at all a political decision, but a business decision. And they feel that it's worth it. I just want to clarify. I mean, I think her views are abhorrent, and I have a very hard time watching her. I just, if we see this time and time again, CNN did this as well with Corey Lewandowski and others that are in deep trouble, and then they immediately get a job on the cable news network. And I don't know what they add to the equation. I don't know what they bring to the table. And I think it's way too early to say what she is going to bring to the table. But as we move forward in a very, what I believe will be a very tumultuous few months of a general election, it seems that at least you want someone to have the inside track of what's going on in the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think both sides can be right. I think it's not incorrect that
we gotta get out. I'm sorry.
It was going to be brilliant, but that's okay. I'll save it for next time.
We'll be brilliant tomorrow. Thanks, Mike.